So now for our last panel of the day, Analytics from the Player's View, be moderated by John Boog-Shambi, an announcer from ESPN. John joined ESPN full-time in 2010 as a play-by-play voice for MLB on ESPN Radio, and he does the same thing for college basketball and MLB on ESPN. John also contributed to ESPN Radio's World Series coverage as an on-site studio host and provided post-game on-field interviews for ESPN SportsCenter. And now he'll introduce our panel, but just want to give a special thanks to Brandon McCarthy. Brandon now is making his third appearance here, three straight years at our analytics conference, and we really appreciate that. Also want to tell everyone that everyone's welcome to join us for the reception immediately following this. It'll be up on the third floor at the Garden Terrace. So now I'll turn it over to John.
So, how's that for you? All right, first I want to welcome up Brian Bannister, former big league pitcher, parts of five seasons with the Royals and the Mets. I know a lot of people in this room have been reading about him and know for his appetite for analytics, and please welcome Brian Bannister. All right, here's the veteran. You've actually been to this one more year than I have, so you're going to teach me the ropes. Brandon McCarthy, everybody. Arizona Diamondbacks, Brandon McCarthy, I'm sorry. All right, there's so much stuff to get into. The first place, though, that I wanted to just begin, I think that a lot of people in this room know background stories for how you guys got involved. Brandon, start with you. ESPN the magazine actually did an article a couple years ago about how you got into analytics, sabermetrics. I know the line that stuck with me. I think you said, "I didn't want to suck anymore." Was that what you said? But tell the story how you got interested in this stuff.
I got interested out of almost necessity. I had started to push myself into becoming more and more of a fringe big leaguer, where the line between surviving and being forced out is increasingly thin. That combined with the fact that I was hurt all the time, it makes you easier to get rid of. I started looking for other things, what I was doing as an actual pitcher when I was healthy and why I was still so mediocre, and that's when I kind of opened myself into new avenues, and it actually started with the Fire Joe Morgan blog. That made me laugh enough, so I started looking deeper into what they were actually talking about, and then I just fell into the wormhole from there, and now here I am.
And Brian, how about you?
For me, same story. It was out of necessity, except where his necessity came in the big league level, mine was in high A ball. So if you notice, he's a little taller than me, a little longer limbs, looks more like a pitcher. So for me, I kind of had a Forrest Gump journey in the game of baseball. I had the privilege of being an 11-year-old sitting in Texas watching Nolan Ryan throw bullpens, and I'd be out there every fifth day watching him throw his bullpens with Tom House. Got to go to USC and pitch alongside Mark Pryor. So once again, Tom House, but he was kind of a specimen as far as all the mechanics stuff. And then even as a rookie with the Mets, I got to watch Pedro Martinez and Tom Glavine up close at the end of their careers, along with my dad, who pitched 15 years. So I've been very blessed as to be surrounded by great pitchers. But for me, I always wanted to be a second baseman, and I really didn't have great stuff. My freshman year in college, I didn't make it as a second baseman at USC. I tried out. They said, "You're not going to make it. We have a full scholarship guy ahead of you. Can you pitch?" And so I topped out at 85 that day. I was sitting 83, throwing kind of sidearm. So my career was a battle the whole time. And for me, just for moral ethical reasons, I wasn't going to take steroids. I wasn't going to go down that path, which some kids were unfortunately choosing to do because it was in the game at the time. And analytics for me kind of happened by accident, just because pitch effects wasn't out, all this other stuff. Moneyball really hadn't happened. And so I started tweaking my pitches, and it was just the start of all this. And like you said, once you go down, you know, once you take the blue pill or the red pill and you're in the matrix, you're stuck in it. So that's where we are now.
Brandon, what percentage of players in big league clubhouses, and again, just take a shot at it, know what FIP is or weighted on base, or at least have some type of cursory knowledge?
If they're good at it, I would say probably 30%. If someone's explained it to them and, hey, you're better than everybody else at this, then they're more apt to buy into that, I guess. I would say on the whole, it's probably still 5 to 10%. There's always a few guys a year that will shock me, and they know something about it. They ask for an explanation on something. It's still not a high percentage, but I think that's also out of necessity. I don't think it has to be a high percentage.
And I know that pitch effects is something, Brian, that helped you. You're a big believer in. Tell me about sort of using that data and how helpful you find it to be.
It was kind of happenstance that my rookie year was 2006, and that was the year it got rolled out. So all of a sudden, here's all this new data. And I'll be the first one to admit that the big league level is the wrong place to reinvent your game. But when you're just trying to stay there and you're trying to be successful there, you'll really use anything, any tool that you have at your disposal. And for me, I would equate it to the way the golfers, if you want to be on the PGA Tour and you're not Tiger Woods or you're not Bubba Watson where you hit the ball a country mile, you really have to optimize the rest of your game. You have to use the equipment. You know, if you switch out your drivers, going from a different loft or a different shaft, you can add 10, 20 yards with the same swing. And that was my approach with pitch effects in the big leagues, was that if I can optimize my game and look at what guys in the big leagues are successful and how their pitches move, and if I can imitate that to what physically I'm capable of, hey, maybe, you know, I'll get some more ground balls and my ERA will go down. And, you know, this is at the forefront of it all, so I was kind of in the haze trying to figure it all out. But, you know, I almost won a Rookie of the Year title. When I tore my rotator cuff in 2009, unfortunately, I threw a shutout in Tampa, and that was kind of the end of my career. I pitched one more year, but, you know, I was in the top 10 in the American League in ERA at that time. And from a kid who was 23 and struggling in high A ball to being in the top 10 in the American League in ERA in August 2009, I mean, it was an amazing journey. And so I get stereotyped as being intellectual or a stat head or a nerd. But for me, it was my steroids. It was my way to get the most out of my ability, and I really enjoyed all that stuff, and that's why I still believe in it today.
It seems like, Brandon, though, you would be an outlier in terms of really the ability to take the information and apply it, because, you know, Brandon Webb just had a gift to be able to throw a sinker. You were a four-seam fastball guy, and then you started to look at stuff and you decided, okay, well, this makes sense. If I throw more two-seamers, more sinkers, more ground balls, less home runs. But not all guys can throw a two-seam fastball, and most guys that throw a four-seam fastball, there's a reason they don't throw a two-seam fastball.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be open and willing to reinvent yourself, and like he talked about, it at the big league level, it's really scary unless the alternative is not being in the big leagues anymore, and then it's less scary. I've said it the last 2 years being here that the biggest thing with all this is not giving this information to the players. It's giving it to an intermediary who can then transfer it to the players and then make something happen. So you might have a player who's on his way out, and you realize if he got more ground balls, X amount per year, whatever it is, he would have more success. How do we make that happen? And then you try and create something that way, as opposed to just giving it something to somebody and saying, you need more ground balls, then you're probably going to fall on deaf ears. But if someone can teach that and teach you, this is how we throw a sinker, bring in people that can teach you to throw a sinker, or whatever else it may be, then there's a better chance for success.
Are players more aware now that they're being evaluated differently? You know, we had the panel with the ESPN crew, and everybody's still saying that players' batting average, home runs, RBIs, but more and more front offices, that's not what they're looking at. Are players aware of that?
I think players are aware of wins above replacement because they get paid on it. I think they're all aware of OPS now. You'll see that on every scoreboard. You know, that slowly came into the game. But I think, just like what Brandon said, the transition, the translation of all this cool data, all these numbers, to how do I turn that into actual performance is still kind of the holy grail. And for me, I think it needs to happen at an earlier age before you get to the big leagues.
So you almost have to brainwash them early so that you don't teach them that average is the end-all, be-all, or wins for a pitcher?
I don't know if it's brainwashing just so much as you're putting forth what's important to you as an organization. And then teaching your guys that as it comes through. There's certain skills that I think are teachable, some that aren't. I think you got into that with Oakland, the teaching guys to take walks versus hitters that are, you know, they do that on their own. So you try and bring those guys into your system. Pitchers that are ground ball ground ball heavy or strikeout heavy, whatever it is you're looking for, you're trying to look for those guys at the beginning as opposed to just creating them all the way through. You're just trying to fix the margins on each little guy and bring him through as he gets to the big leagues. You have something closer to what you're looking for, but I don't think you can overhaul everybody right from the get-go.
I want both of you to react to this one. There was an interesting piece in Baseball Prospectus in December about the Oakland A's and about an advantage that they seem to have found, or at least certainly intent, and that is to load up on fly ball hitters. And 60% of their plate appearances last year were taken by fly ball hitters. And one of the things that it's found is that fly ball hitters match up well with ground ball pitchers. So, and as well, they use a platoon split to right and left-handed. If I were to come to you going into a series and tell you, all right, fellas, the data says a lot of fly ball hitters, you can do what with that information?
I don't do anything different with it. That might sound weird, but it's still just where does he hit the ball well? Where does he like to try and swing at? I mean, what are his pros, what are his cons, what can he do? That's what I would look at first and foremost. The fact that he's pop-up or a ground ball hitter in the end might matter some, but it doesn't change the way I would approach him. It's still, I have my strengths, he has his weaknesses, I'm going to try and put the two together and find out where they are. So it's, you're just trying to still get him from driving the ball. I don't care if you hit it soft in the air.
Yeah, I think the fundamental thing that's strange about the game of baseball from a player's perspective is that the majority of people, if you were young or right now and you grabbed a baseball and you threw it to me, most people would be kind of high three quarters, four seam, they'd put backspin on it. And the reality is from a pitcher's perspective, that's actually the worst way to throw a ball, because you're actually, by putting backspin on the ball, unless you have one of those top 1% of arms in the world where you throw very high velocity, very high spin, you're actually helping a hitter hit the bottom half of the ball. And so you look at the pitchers at the big league level, and the guys that are successful are the guys who have those top 1% of arms where they can actually miss a guy's bat by his fastball being above the bat. You're talking about your Kershaws and your Yordano Venturas and guys that just have electric arms. But the majority of us don't have that. And so when I'm working with kids and doing lessons, you know, if the kid doesn't have just an off-the-charts arm, you're actually going to be more successful if you're working on helping hitters hit the top half of the ball. And you do that by either throwing a two-seamer, by throwing a cutter. I mean, that was the secret to my career, from getting stuck at an A-ball level to getting to the big leagues and being able to contribute a little bit, was I threw 40 to 60% cutters because my cutter broke down. And so all of a sudden, my ground ball rate went up, and I was able to pitch in the big leagues. I wasn't a great pitcher, but I got to pitch that level, and that was my dream. So when I take information like that, knowing they're trying to hit fly balls, they should be trying to hit fly balls, because all the damage in the game, you don't hit a home run on a ground ball. And so as a pitcher, you're trying to eliminate that part of the game and prevent them either by swings and misses or by getting them hit the top half through the movement on your pitches or location or however you're trying to do it.
You talk a lot about defensive analytics and that being something that, you know, really trying to refine. What's the next set of data or information for players that will be useful in improving performance, in your opinion?
All the stuff that was released recently with the efficiency rating, I thought that was fascinating. I think being able to look at the game defensively will change a lot of stuff. Everybody has looked at zone rating. Everybody's looked at different defensive metrics and looked at them with kind of a guarded eye. They haven't really bought into them all the way. And it's also hard when you're trying to quantify it in terms of runs, because it's hard to explain to people what that means. And I think that way, just even the what was coming up when people were showing it, it's just very simple graphics. It shows you the optimal route, what the route, you know, the player took. I think that is extremely interesting. I think that's going to be kind of the new thing. And if that's combined with some sort of a hit FX system and you can find, did you actually drive the ball? Is the ball placed well? Whatever it is. I think that's the newest frontier.
I think it's the pitch effects and the hit effects at the younger ages, just because, you know, there's really not a lot of hit effect stuff out there. It's been talked about, but especially from the player side, you don't really have access to it. But matching up your body type, your strength, your bat speed with how the ball is launched off your bat. I mean, if you're a smaller guy who really has no chance of hitting a home run, or maybe will hit one occasionally, there's really no reason why you should be hitting the ball in the air, just because you're not going to generate ideal batted balls. You're really trying to hit line drives, and all that will come back where you're trying to generate the highest OPS possible and be the most productive player. And as a from a player's perspective, if you're in the cage, you want to be training that way. There's no reason to be hitting balls with too high of a launch angle or too much spin if it's not going to help you in a game at all. And so for me, I think having the players be able to train in a way that will help them the most in the game from an earlier age, so that by the time they get to the big league level, it's just automatic. They have that muscle memory, and they're not even thinking about it. And I think that's the next step with all this stuff.
What numbers are you guys looking at these days as far as evaluating your own performance or getting a sense of what's really happening on the field?
I haven't veered too off course. I still look at the, kind of the standard ones that I've been following the last few years. I started looking more at swing percentages in the zone, out of the zone, and then contact percentages, which cause I think can be telling, especially when last year, the whole year, I felt like my stuff was never there. I wasn't as sharp as I wanted to be. And then sure enough, that shows up there where more stuff in the zone is getting hit. They're swinging at less stuff out of the zone, which means they're non-competitive pitches. That's all things that kind of show that you're trending down in that year. So kind of correcting those things was a big focus for me this year, and they're more just a confirmation of what you already know. I think when you get done, you know exactly what happened. Sometimes the stats just reaffirm that to you, but it's nice to at least have something there where you can say, I think I was giving up more contact in the zone, more balls were falling in, whatever it is. But so I still kind of look at everything to get a big picture, and I actually don't look too much at hitters or anything too advanced when I go outside of myself.
I think the defensive stuff is curious because, you know, when you pitched, you had an idea or at least an opinion on who was a good individual defender. And now with the positioning and moving guys, how do you get a total sense for how much credit should be given to the individual player as opposed to the team and the bench coach for positioning a guy?
It's funny because the Royals now have one of the best defenses in baseball. And I was just a couple years too early because I really needed it because I didn't strike out a lot of guys. You know, for me, I struck out guys in the minor leagues because the umpires would expand the zone for me. And so when I got to the big leagues, it was a shock. And I remember talking to Tom Glavin about this. Questech kind of revolutionized the game as far as the umpires being held accountable for the pitches they call. And then that transitioned into pitch FX. And Tom told me in 2006, he said, I can't pitch the way I used to pitch. And so all these people that still preach the Atlanta way, the Leo Mazzone way, it doesn't exist anymore because you can't throw a pitch 1 or 2 inches off the plate and earn it the way that you used to and have great games sitting out there. And so you really have to pitch in the zone more often. And so for a guy like me who naturally is a fly ball pitcher with my fastball, I really had to go cutter heavy and try and generate those ground balls. So defense was huge for me. And now as we get better and better at, looking at the zones and where guys are hitting it, I mean, it just becomes that much more important. And it would have helped me tremendously.
And what about for you in terms of positioning? I mean, you're trying to get the ball hit on the ground. You have an idea of which of your defenders are good defenders, but you're also dependent, at least in part, as you know, most teams are they positioned in the proper spot?
Yeah, it's something that I want to have happen. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to know about it. I just want to focus solely on executing the pitch, and that's it. Whatever it is that I have to do on this pitch to get the ball to go somewhere harmlessly. I hope someone's there. I hope it's just an easy routine ground ball. There's four guys on that side of the infield. Great. Whatever it is, my job is to just induce weak contact as often as possible. But I think the advancements that we're making in terms of shifting and all that, taking the game away from the hitters, I'm all for. I think it's awesome to watch games like that happen because you see someone hit a screaming line drive and then sure enough there's someone standing there, and that's just smart baseball.
Now, do you get frustrated when it goes through the spot? We talked on a panel earlier that the one spot that probably it's going to go in one out of every 15 times?
Yeah, but that's
– it is what
it is. I would rather have that than we just haven't shifted into an area knowing this guy likes to pull and he just gets to comfortably hit a two-hopper through the hole. It's much better to watch David Ortiz hit a screaming line drive and it one hops the second baseman who's playing short right field and then throw him out at first and you realize I didn't make a great pitch, he's out. Like, we've won this the smart way, and that's a lot more fun.
Brian, I know you have some strong ideas in terms of how analytics and in a lot of different ways can help in terms of youth baseball and at the minor league level. What are some of those things that you think that will impact player performance in a positive way?
You know, all this stuff is finally available to you as a player at the big league level. And, you know, like what Brandon's going through, you're going out there and you just have to perform. It's not, it's not the right time at the big league level to be reinventing the wheel or to be changing things. It was extremely stressful for me, but it was just because, I mean, you're treading water, you're trying to survive because there's so many talented players up there. So the time from a coaching perspective, and I'm not talking about the guys that have a ton of talent. I'm not talking about the guys that already throw 100 miles an hour, the Steven Strasburgs of the world that just go from college straight up there and their stuff translate and they don't have to change a thing. There's a lot of guys like me in the minor leagues, a lot of guys like me in college, in high school, at the lower levels. And for me, I think you give them the right tools, you explain the game to them. Not everybody has access to great coaching. I was very blessed that I was around good players my whole life and around the game at the highest level. So I had a little bit of an edge that way. But I would like to give that same advantage to the kids, and especially the minor league guys. You go and talk to them about things, and there's things that they've never heard of because you don't even get access to it until the big league level. So analytics is awesome, and we've come so far since it went mainstream with Moneyball and all this new technology is coming out, and there's more technology coming out next year. But at some point, it has to filter down the players to the players' level. And for me, the big thing is, you know, the Sabre and everything was kind of always on the side. And you see front offices putting in analytics departments, and it's becoming more a part of the game. If we really want to transition it over to be integrated in the game, it has to start with the kids who, when they come up, are going to be the players, are going to be the future coaches in the game, the future front office people, and then it's all integrated. And it's just a part of the way that baseball is played. And so that's what I'm excited about. At some point, it has to filter down so that it's a part of how players train, how they practice, and then there's a whole industry built around it.
Back to the big league level, I think I remember a story. Was it your first year when you had success, but you were aware that you had a really low batting average allowed on balls in play? So did you go into the off season sitting there saying, oh man, I'm going to regress to the mean the next year, or what?
I actually got visited by Forrest McCracken.
Visited?
Yes. He showed up in Surprise. Apparently he lives in Surprise, out with the Royals. And it was just a funny moment because he basically came up with the concept of it. Mm-hmm. And it was, there was some validity to it. You see it happen to a lot of guys who are not high strikeout guys in the big leagues and who do have a very fortunate year as far as how the balls are put in play. So for me, you know, I thought about it, and I kind of went back to how I was pitching when I struggled in high A. And that was more fastball heavy, trying to get strikeouts. And I really had a bad year. And I kind of stepped back afterwards, and I was like, okay, what did I do wrong? And then I started realizing, you know, I just don't have the stuff to pitch with my fastball in the big league level. I can't miss bats over their bat like the top guys do. So I have to now go to the other side. And that's when I really developed my changeup. And my changeup the next year, I started throwing that more. And I stopped trying to throw it slow. I stopped trying to take 10 miles an hour off and slow my body down or choke the grip or all these things that pitchers try and do, because every pitching coach in the world tells you changeup's got to be 10 miles an hour slower than your fastball. It's the only way it's going to be effective. And you've had all kinds of conversations with Harry. And the great thing about a changeup is you can actually throw it hard as long as it has sink. So if you look at the pitch effects data, and you mentioned Brandon Webb's sinker, Brandon Webb's sinker and my changeup that year in 2009 had the exact same sink on it. And it was crazy. I mean, I was a dead fly ball pitcher, and I went all the way up to a lot of ground balls that year, and my changeup was getting over 60% ground balls, and I just started throwing that thing, and it was great. And I didn't try and throw it slow. And so that's weird for a kid to hear. You don't have to throw your changeup slow, and here I am at the big league level throwing an 87-mile-an-hour changeup with a 90-mile-an-hour fastball and having a ton of success with it. And it's kind of unorthodox, but according to the pitch effects and according to the batted ball results, it was the best thing I could have done.
You mentioned Boros and the defense-independent pitching. Brandon, you made the comment, talked about inducing weak contact. And I guess you'd say that there's still the idea of how much control does a pitcher have on a ball that is in play. Both of you, what's your take on it? Because I think that it's an idea that continues to move a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know that you have control of it in play. You have control of where you put the ball, which then somewhat controls how hard the ball is hit in the play. I think it really is is as uncomplicated as that. If I hit my spot where I want, which is a place that's not optimal for the hitter to hit it, the idea that the chance that he barrels it up is very unlikely, which then works in my favor, that the ball is much softer, much easier to defend. He has less chance for success. That doesn't mean you're going to get away with everything. But it's one of the reasons why the best hitters in the game are the best hitters in the game, because they barrel up way more balls. There are pitches last year that we all remember from Miguel Cabrera, 3-4 inches off the plate, and all of a sudden he's got a barrel on it, and nobody else in the game does that, and that's what makes Miguel Cabrera Miguel Cabrera. Other hitters have their hot zones that exist 2 inches off the plate, 3 inches in, wherever it is. They can hit those hard. If you stay away from those zones, it can still be on the plate. They can still make contact all they want, but it's not their best contact, which then raises a chance in my favor of being successful.
I kind of have a nerdy outlook theory on this, is that...
Yeah.
You have a round bat and a round ball. And so when you look at the pitch effects data, you see the guys. So we'll throw Brandon Webb again. He typically... His fastball sunk literally almost at the rate of gravity, as if you just held a ball here and dropped it. He was 1 to 2 inches above that as it's falling towards home plate. I mean, that was why he was one of the best sinkers in baseball. You know, he was up in that 63-64% ground ball range on his fastball, which is incredible. And so what happens is, you know, if you picture a bell curve and you picture a guy's fastball, how much sink is on there? The guys who have more sink, the hitters are actually going to hit higher on the ball, the top half, more often because the ball is sinking at a faster rate. So I actually believe there's something to the quality of ground balls. Just because you throw a pitch and it gets classified as a ground ball, I think a Brandon Webb type guy is getting a 4 to 5 hop ground ball, whereas my ground balls, because my pitches weren't sinking as much, you know, they're 1-2 hoppers. You know, they're hit with a little more steam because they're barreling it up a little more. They're hitting more of the middle half of the ball. And so I think there is something to the quality of the sink you're getting, or the RPMs on your breaking balls. As it's diving more, guys are just naturally going to hit the top half of the ball more. And so the quality of the ground balls is different.
Is that the same, like you said, with even going the other way, with Matt Cain being a high fly ball tendency pitcher, and it always, he keeps so many of them in the park, I think it's that same thing. He has one of those fastballs you were talking about that just jumps. It doesn't ever seem to get down to where your barrel is. It stays above it. And then all his fly balls that look like they should be more dangerous than they are just end up being harmless little flyouts, and that... I think it exists on both planes. It's why every pitcher goes for the latest movement they can get. Once the human eye stops seeing it, you hope they've swung at one spot and the ball just isn't where he thought his barrel was going to be, and then you avoid hard contact.
And my first professional at bat in AA was off of Matt Cain. I'll never forget. I fouled off 13 straight pitches and ended up popping out to second base. And I love to hit. I wanted to be a hitter so I can handle the bat a little bit, and I could not get on top of his fastball. There were only a couple of guys in the game. Strasburg was one. Eric Bedard was one in 2006 when I faced in spring training. I mean, you literally go to hit their fastball, and it just, it's like a vapor. It just rises over your bat. It's a crazy phenomenon until you actually try to hit it. I mean, it's like almost like a wiffle ball, and that's how much spin and velocity they have on it.
Well, he and Hellickson are kind of two guys that have confounded probably some of the people in this room, and then Kane has a year a little bit like he had last year, and now you wonder you know, whether it is a true skill and he's kind of an outlier, or how that ends up working. Is he someone that can induce soft contact in the air?
I do think that. There's still, no matter what you look at when you regress, there's still quality of pitches. And I would be willing to bet that if you took his pitch FX from the 2 years and put them side by side, there's just more pitches that are over the middle of the plate, more in a hittable zone, as opposed to there was when he was having success. So there's a chance it regresses all the way and we're wrong, but I think enough hitters come back to the dugout and tell you the same thing over and over and over again before you're just kind of arguing against, you don't really know what you're arguing against. Once major league hitters are seeing it and it becomes true, then it's, you feel like it's probably the case.
All right, we talk about all this information, and you mentioned the idea of an intermediary. Information overload can be a real issue. Where are we today as far as disseminating this information so that it is useful to the average major league player?
You know, I think some organizations do it better than others, and I think they know who they are. They have more proprietary information. They're more committed to it. They're using it at every level as opposed to just the big league level, or even some organizations aren't using it that much at the big league level. And it's just a choice. There's philosophies. But I think if you are going to commit to it, it's got to be a part of your system. It's got to be a part of your approach, because I know I felt kind of alienated using it. And, you know, why are you thinking out there on the mound? Or, you get all these stereotypes, and, hey, I'm just trying to be the most productive player I can be and go out there and get you wins. And so, yes, it was early. I mean, this was 2006, 2007, and it's more mainstream now. But there still is a hurdle there as far as what the data is and what the players are hearing and how they're using it.
Yeah, I don't – the intermediary thing is going to be a slow-moving thing, but I think it's done from the top down. You see the organizations that are doing it well. You see some that are just leaving it behind, and they're getting left behind. I think it's – even like with Mike Fast going to the Astros, you know they're doing something with catching there. I've heard every organization has their own catching philosophies, their own catching metrics. Even the recent article that came out with it, I thought was fascinating, and to know that other organizations are doing their own things with that. So that's something they're probably looking for in their scouting, and they're combining the two sides now. You're scouting catchers who do what they find to be successful, and then teaching that little by little. And if you're not successful with that, unless you just absolutely clobber the ball, you don't move up a level. So you just kind of, I guess, drop off the ones that don't really conform to what you're doing without having to totally explain it to them. And this is what you have to do. This is... you can teach it so much before you just lose somebody. So you find people who can do it naturally, and those become your types of players, which is what excites me about the future of baseball, is seeing distinct different styles between teams instead of one just homogenous, everybody looks the same, some team has more money. It's just simply this team does it this way, and they're better than us by doing it completely differently than we do it.
You have conversations with teammates where you might look at their numbers or suggest something that would move towards analytics as a suggestion, as an observation. I know you played with Zach Greinke. He's got some ideas.
Yeah, I mean, Zach Cy Young year. I mean, it'd be really fun if we could have documented it in real time, but that was probably one of the greatest sabermetric years from a player's perspective of all time. We had all this information. We were in between innings running in and checking the pitch FX data. And it was actually really fun, and, you know, it's fun from my perspective when you have somebody like Zach who, on his last pitch of the game, it's 98, and his slider that year was one of the best pitches in baseball. So it's something that I never had the physical tools to actually go out there and accomplish. But he was using his amazing ability, combining it with the best information out there, and going out and really just dominating the game that year. And that was a lot of fun. There were certain things he did, like throwing that nasty slider. It was hard on his shoulder a little bit, and he doesn't throw it as often. But it was really fun. We were literally tweaking pitches to get the optimum break. And, I mean, it was one of the greatest years I've ever witnessed personally. And we had a lot of fun that year using all this data and really going out there and trying to beat the game.
Have you used Insight to help teammates or talk to teammates?
Yes and no, but nothing seriously. Teammates that I have a better relationship with, or there's just natural banter and you're going back and forth making fun of each other, you can throw things out that let them know something about themselves that they might not know, but they probably do know. I don't get in-depth with it because I don't get too in-depth with it with myself. So I don't, it doesn't need to be a know-it-all thing. It doesn't need to be pushing anything on anybody. It's just simply, I think the other thing is a lot of guys use analytics. They get it inside their own mind without having seen it. Guys naturally know who is aggressive on the first pitch. Guys naturally know who swings out of the zone. So while they don't have concrete numbers to it in their head, they have a pretty good idea just by being around the game, observing it, pitching to certain hitters, facing certain pitchers. So you don't really have to bring it up and quantify it with an exact number to them, because then it gets lost. They know it instinctually, and then that's kind of how I find that it's easier to bring that stuff across.
All right, one of the ones that I've been dying to bring up with you, I think it was – maybe 2 years ago, a Twitter conversation. You're a little bit active on Twitter. And Kevin Goldstein, who's now with the Astros, and I chirped in a little bit, but the idea of closer usage and the efficiency of closer usage. It's interesting because when you look at it, the numbers say that in the eighth inning, that guy is pretty consistently going to face a higher quality of competition. Better hitters, and yet you consistently use your best pitcher in the ninth inning. How can that ever change? Or from a player standpoint, how do we get to a place where the closer might be more willing to be used in the eighth but not the ninth, et cetera? I have some other follow-ups on it. But you remember the discussion with Kevin Goldstein?
I've had this discussion. I've actually had this discussion more in a baseball clubhouse on plane flights than I've had any other thing that follows sabermetric principles, and that's the misusage of your relief ace. I've never understood it. It makes no sense to me. You don't save your number one starter for Game 7 of the World Series if you can win it in Game 6. It just doesn't make any sense. But I think it's coming along now. There's still the mental side of it. You don't want to lose a game in the ninth inning no matter what. It deflates the team. I don't think that carries over, but I totally get it from a manager perspective. You don't want to face the media. You don't want to answer those questions. You don't want to second guess yourself when you can stick with the status quo and just kind of shake it off as a thing that happened and moved on. But I think some teams are changing it now financially. You see what the A's are doing. You pay a little bit more for that, but you get to hold other guys back. I think that might be a way. There's so many guys that are coming in who can be closers, who can be relief aces because they have the stuff. Let them throw early or hold them down financially, which I don't agree with, but it makes sense. And then just eventually you pay some sort of a proven closer to sit there in the back. Whether or not he's your best pitcher, it kind of takes that onus away from having to use who was actually your best pitcher in that ninth inning and wasting him.
Similar thing. I don't think we're ever going to get rid of the closer. I think there's the save stat, the money that's paid to players, the agent's desire to have their guy be the closer, the respect you get with the closer title, kind of the reverence of knowing I can be in the clubhouse till the fifth inning, come out, ride the bike in the seventh, stretch in the eighth, and then I close the game. That's me. I don't think that's ever going to go away because it's so ingrained. I don't think it will. But I think we're going to get into, a floating guy, a second closer where he's the high leverage guy. I could see.
But why wouldn't the high leverage guy be the best guy?
It's the whole ninth inning thing. I really think there's a stigma with it, and teams don't want to blow it in the ninth. The manager doesn't want to deal with it. The agent doesn't want his guy to be a floating guy. That closer guy wants to know, I got the ninth. It's my inning. I've earned it. That's me. And so you start to see two closers where one guy, whether he's not as veteran as that guy, even if he's the better pitcher, for a while he'll be used as that floating guy in the highest leverage situation in the game. I think that's the only way we can resolve that issue, just because I don't think they're going to take away the closer from the ninth inning.
I think the only other way is you bring up an organization, you have guys come up through where it doesn't exist. Once you are in the bullpen, you are in the bullpen from the fifth inning on, unless you are the long guy, and that's what we've designated you because you're stretched out. You are available at any point. Be ready. And one of the things they do with relievers early on is even on rookie ball teams, you designate a guy a closer, an eighth inning guy, a seventh inning guy, and it doesn't make any sense because you don't know these guys yet. Their stuff doesn't necessarily say that. They're going to move up another level. They don't have big league closer stuff, so why you're anointing them that at an earlier level, as opposed to just teaching them bullpen flexibility, which would then pay off when you get to the big leagues. When you get to the big leagues, there's by a week two of spring training, guys in the bullpen start wondering who's going to be the seventh inning guy, who's the eighth inning guy, there's closer battles, there's all this nonsense going on I think if you brought people through the right way, it would just be you are a bullpen guy, we are going to use you in the highest leverage situation we can get you where you are expected to have the most success. I think that's the only way, true way to change it, is to make it a full organizational shift. Who's going to be the first to pull the trigger on that? I don't know.
Money actually factors in as well. If I could guarantee that guys wouldn't get paid at all on saves, if I could throw that out, it would probably move it towards more efficiency,
yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, that plays into it. The other thing is comfort level. This is just sort of generic, but the other part of it is, and you touched on it, I show up at the ballpark, I go in there and eat cupcakes in the fifth, and then I ride the bike, and then I go take a shower, and then I come in the ninth. What's the tipping point as far as a manager putting a guy in a spot that he's not comfortable in, but that's the best usage of that player? Like, how do you navigate that, like, from a player's perspective? I don't want to hit second, but that's probably the best place. I don't want to pitch in the eighth inning, but that's probably the best spot. How do you deal with the idea, well, I'm not comfortable doing that, so I don't want to do it?
I think communication and it just being an organizational philosophy. You get there and this is the way things are done. If I want to, you can go scream and pout about it in the corner if you want, but you're not going to get your way. One of the best examples I saw of that was in Oakland in 2012, the platooning of almost the entire team. And you have a whole bunch of guys who are set in their ways. They want to play against their certain pitchers. They want to do what they want to do. And then you had a good manager who effectively communicated to them, you're not playing this day, we're going to play in this. And you saw the platoon thing happening, success happened, and guys just eventually you get on board or you're pushed to the outside. I think that would be the same case there, where you might be more comfortable or you might have been more comfortable throwing in the ninth somewhere else, except here, you are now the guy. We will use you with the highest leverage point in this game, and that will be your job, and you get comfortable with that. And if you are looking to sign a free agent, if he's not comfortable with that, then you don't sign him. Or if you bring guys through and you brought Kimbrel through and you put him in that role and say, listen, you just get all the big outs. We want you for the big outs, whether it's a ninth or the sixth or the seventh. And then maybe that's the other way. It's just the guys that are brought up through know it, and then everybody 2 years on is on board.
And I think it's tough. You know, arbitration, for example, is pretty antiquated in the stats that are brought up in those arguments. And, you know, why would a relief pitcher want to pitch the highest leverage situations if there's no way to value it or get paid off of it? I mean, it's kind of a weird concept, but there's a reason why guys want to become the closer, is because the save is a stat that's been verified and you can make money off of it, and it's just part of the game. And so guys don't want that role because you never know what inning you're going to pitch in. It's usually way more stressful than starting the ninth with a clean slate. There's a lot of, from a player's perspective, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to be in that role. It's a little more comfortable to be the closer. And so it's just one of those weird idiosyncrasies of the game.
How much impact can there be in terms of unwiring the, well, that's just the way we've always done it? Manny Acta was on the panel earlier, and he said one of the ways that he learned about sabermetrics is that a kid came up to him and said, you know, you have a better chance of scoring with no outs and a man at first than one out with a man at second, the idea of a sacrifice bunt. Like, let me ask you this. What percentage of players do you think know that? And I know it doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Maybe 25, 30%. I think people are becoming more familiar with it. We're seeing less and less bunting, less and less stolen bases, and some people are asking why, and then it gets explained to them. So I think it's a slow move, but people are seeing it and realizing that it's being phased out.
But there's still the, you know, at times, I remember a couple years ago, I think it might have been when you were there, Derek Barton, maybe 16, 17 sacrifice bunts. I think half of them were in the first inning, which I would assume would mean he's doing it on his own.
Yeah, I could be. I don't – was that when I was there? There might have been something behind that, but I don't remember being that annoyed as I would seem like I would be now.
But regardless of the fact, the idea of – is that explained enough, and do you think it's something that should be explained more in terms of increasing your percentages to score, et cetera?
I don't know who it has to be explained to. And this is the thing. Everybody is so cautious about in the baseball player psyche and what this will do to who. Everybody adapts and moves on really, really quickly. Now, if you told Billy Hamilton we're not stealing bases anymore because it's detrimental, that might be a thing because that's a career-altering thing for him. Nobody's made their career on bunting. And if they have, they're not a very good player and they probably didn't stay very long. They might be good at hitting and running, making contact, doing that, doing other facets, but as an actual bunter, you weren't getting phased out of the game. Now, if someone said, we're not hitting for power anymore, you'd have a lot of people pissed off and wanting to know why. The rest of it is just something that you just adapt and move on, and every year there's little shifts in the game, and this changes and this moves, and you just get on board or you don't, and I think that's the easiest way, and with more front offices having saber-inclined people in front of them, eventually these things start coming from the top down, and you realize this is just how it is.
What's your take?
I think there needs to be communication between the front office, between the analytics guys. I know there's a huge disconnect between the players showing up every day. And some of these, you come into spring training 1 year, and there's almost like a theme. Like, this year we're going to hit the ball the other way more. Or, you know, it happens all the time. It's just
every year. Every single year.
It's just, you know, it's like the players coming into spring training. It's, you know, I'm working on a new pitch. I'm in the best shape of my life. It happens every year. And I think the teams feel a need to have some – outlook or theme for the year. But really, if you're known for something, you know, the A's are known for something, the Cardinals are known for something, the Red Sox are known for something. If there's certain organizations that have really created an identity, and it's fun as a player when you're drafted for a specific reason, you're developed for a specific reason, and, I mean, you really go to war with that style, and it's perfectly okay because you know that everybody's on board with it. It's hard when it's kind of wishy-washy and from year to year, you don't really know what your style is going to be, or the manager gets fired and then all of a sudden it's a whole new style the next year and it's not an organizational top-down thing. I think that's really tough for a player.
You guys watching the postseason?
Yeah, I watched a decent amount. If I'm home, I try and catch most everything, but if I have an excuse to go out, then I'll go away.
And how much do you watch and think about tactics and percentages when you're watching in the postseason?
I think it's really interesting to see how the managers go about certain things, because I think their style really comes out. The game slows down. I mean, the games get extended. And, you know, I really enjoy watching certain organizations in the postseason. I love watching the Red Sox. I love watching the Cardinals. Because I know that they've prepared, and it's just a continuation of what they've done for the whole year already. It's not, oh, we made the playoffs this year, and now everything we did in the regular season we're going to throw out, and, you know, we're going to bear down, and we're going to finally win this year. I mean, it has to be something that is established, no matter what your method is of approaching the game. It's got to be something that all your players can rely on, because the pressure steps up, the intensity steps up, there's more media, there's more fans, more TV, and you can't be changing things at that point. So I love watching the postseason because you really see the teams go, you know, we are the Cardinals or we are the Pirates, and we're gonna lose the Pirate way.
I in the postseason, I like watching the pitcher-hitter matchups the most. Those are the most fascinating things, and those are the ones that I think should stand out more than anything, and I wish broadcasts would do more with in the postseason. As a casual viewer and even as an advanced viewer, there is so much information that could be given right here of the highest probability of this pitch being here, there's a chance he doesn't hit this, whatever it is that you give us, it's fantastic. And watching Detroit's pitching staff last year, watching St. Louis's pitching staff, every single one of their guys pitched just to their strengths and just to the weaknesses. They didn't try anything new. They didn't try anything cute. And you watch them against a lineup like Oakland, they matched up well, and they ran right through them again, or at least Verlander and Scherzer did. And you see their success line up, and there's a lot of people that are sitting at home watching, and they're going, they just keep missing the changeup. Why they keep missing the changeup? I think you could teach the viewer so much more based on that stuff. What are they watching? Why are they watching it? That's what fascinates me the most, and knowing that you can pretty much call pitches in the postseason and think this is what's coming here and know full well that if he executes it, it will be successful.
I'm going to take some questions before we do. I want each of you to give some input in terms of how our broadcast could be better integrating analytics to help make people smarter about baseball.
I don't know that it has to be analytics on the level that we're talking about. Like I said, the most fascinating thing to me is a pitcher-hitter matchup. Whether it has to be pure numbers, whether it's hot and cold zones, whether it's simplified stuff, but just gives the hitter or gives the viewer a better idea of what might happen and explaining why this might happen and then finding out after. I don't think it has to be zone rating. I don't think it has to be tons of extra stats that even as baseball players we can't totally get into. It can be simplified version of here's what you're about to see. Get ready.
The stuff I like to see, it's the pitcher-batter matchup. And what I like seeing is what a pitcher's strength is. You know, I love watching a guy like Kershaw or Johan Santana back in the day where, their strikes in the zone, you know, the swings and misses in the zone. I love, even if it was just like a little blurb on the side. So, you know, the casual fan doesn't really get bothered by it or even notice it. But then you can kind of see what a guy's percentages are. And then you can see throughout the game, you know, is that matching up? You know, does he, you know, they only make contact 70% of the pitches in the zone when they swing. And, you know, this guy all of a sudden he comes in, he doesn't have as good a stuff, and it's 85 or 90% of the time they're making contact in the zone. You know, it can be just little subtle things where the advanced viewer can really pick up on it and get a little more enjoyment out of the game. But it doesn't get really distracting, and the commentators who are so good, they don't have to get, you know, really nerdy on it all, but I think it caters to both audiences.
How about some questions? Go ahead.
Apurva Parikh, Rutgers University. How has your routine changed since going from analytics to what you were doing before in terms of like time and effort and efficiency?
That's a good question. It actually didn't change a whole lot. I spent enough time just being randomly on the internet for no real reason. So it gives me one extra to two extra websites to visit when I think I've run out of internet. So then I just go to Fangraphs and look at something with no real purpose, but I actually can start breaking down starts after, at least. My first thing that I do once PitchFX is available is I go look at it, make sure that everything falls within certain parameters that I want it to be in, if there's anything that stands out, good things or bad things, and then I move on. But beyond that, once I take that information and decide what I want to do with it, everything stays the same.
I think one of the biggest deficiencies in preparing the players for the games is that you have your advanced scouts watching the games, and they're creating hot-cold zones. And before a game or before a series, depending on your organization, how you prepare it, you're giving all this information to your pitching staff. And I will never forget Rick Peterson with the Mets. We were going through, and we were talking about this hitter and this hitter, and all of a sudden he came to this hitter, and he's like, do not throw this guy a fastball. He is just on fire with fastballs. And Billy Wagner looks at him and he's like, I only have a fastball. and the guy throws 103 miles an hour from the left side. Like, why would you not tell a guy to throw a fastball? Or, you have to pitch this guy down and away. Everybody that's pitching him down and away, he's just struggling. Well, I'm a fly ball pitcher. If I throw a fastball down and away and he hits a home run off me, were all these guys that were throwing him, were they all sinker ball guys? So you can't just, in general, say, throw this area to this guy. I mean, you really have to break it down. What kind of pitcher are you? And the guys that you were scouting ahead of time, what kind of pitchers were they? Because, I mean, you can almost make it worse for a guy if you tell him to go away from his strengths just because a guy's hitting well recently on a certain zone or a certain pitch.
So I was curious on your perspective about catchers. There's been a number of studies coming out lately that have shown, to me, a shockingly large impact on pitch framing. I was wondering if those, on the order of 20 runs a season, I was wondering if those numbers rang true to you in your experience, and if you buy those numbers.
I do 100%. Looking at it, it's a lot of it's just, again, like I said, it's confirmation of stuff that you think you already knew, but it helps hammer that point home. Some of them are surprising, and those are the ones that kind of fall back in the media, and you think someone's better than they are, and they're actually a little bit worse, but the guys at the top and the guys at the bottom, you can just simply watch a game and realize that guy's not very good, this guy's incredible. I think there's a fascinating amount of work to be done in there, just finding out who can get you strikes, who can't. But the best look like the best, and then finding out that they're that much better is nice to see.
And for me, going from the minor leagues, where I actually did strike out guys, to the big leagues where all of a sudden my strikeouts got cut in half per game, and a big part of it is you lose the edges of the plate. And so one thing we've seen is that the strike zone has become narrower, but then also the bottom part of the zone has really been added in almost subconsciously or purposely by the umpires. And I noticed that specifically. And I think what's happened is the pitchers have adjusted where they can't expand the zone on the sides like they used to. And so you end up, just to survive in the big leagues, you have to develop pitches that really break down and you miss down, whether that's a sinking changeup, a split, a slider that goes down. Just because you don't really get calls off the plate like you used to, and you can't earn it over the course of a game, and it's worthless even if your catcher is trying to frame it out there. So I think because more guys pitch between the edges of the plate and pitch it down because they're trying to get ground balls, I think the umpires have kind of naturally maybe added a little bit at the bottom of the zone.
Do you guys see more pitchers using PitchFX as the technology gets better, and if so, what do you think they can get out of it?
I think a lot of that is who is breaking it down to them, who is teaching them what with it. Someone might think they have a good sinker, and then they can be shown, listen, data-wise, your sinker is right in the middle of the pack. It's nothing better than what you think it is. Or it might be a way to get someone to get rid of a pitch that someone is hanging on to and they keep getting beat on, and they can use PitchFX to show them, listen, it's not very good. This is data. I think in Pittsburgh last year was the only stadium I saw that actually had PitchFX data coming up live on the scoreboard next to the velocity, and it blew everybody's mind in the dugout. What the hell is this? This is minus, plus, all this, and you're trying to explain it, but it was really interesting to see that stuff happen really quick. There's 8 inches of depth on it. There's this. And one of the days we were there, we saw Charlie Morton throw, and you realize really quickly someone else pitched somewhere in that series, and they realize, hey, that number's way bigger than so-and-so's sinker, and you're like, well, that's why his sinker is way better. So I think guys will slowly grab it and understand the concepts, but that'll still be a slow-moving thing until you get more people who can teach that to them.
Who presents it when it's shown?
In Pittsburgh?
No, I'm saying who presents like pitch effects inside to someone on your team, suggests it, shows it to them.
That's a risky. Again, I don't think it has to be done that way. It can be given to the pitching coach, who his job should be, listen, we need more depth on this guy's sinker. We need this curveball isn't good. And the pitching coach is the one who says, listen, you're not throwing a curveball anymore. We have to find a way to get more tilt on your slider, whatever it is. Then it's his job to filter it to you using proper terms and not coming to you with this big graph you can't understand and you're, wait, which side of the plate is a hitter on? I don't understand pitch FX. And then you've lost the guy. So just bringing him to him in simple terms and just saying, this is what we need out of you. Let's go get this.
And that's why I continue to believe that it has to be done at a lower level, whether it's the minor league level for a professional organization or some other level where it's really tough when you go from a AAA player to the big leagues and all of a sudden things are different. I mean, most people don't know the ball literally changes a little bit. Like the seams are different and the strike zone definitely gets narrower. And the hitters are better, and they have more power, and you get punished more. And so things change, and so that's not the time to be changing stuff. What you want to do is prepare a guy so that in your bullpen sessions in the minor leagues, you're preparing him so, hey, this is how a good changeup moves, or this is how your fastball should move, or this is where you just compare to the rest of the league. And so that way they're prepared. They've done everything they can to get the most out of your ability. So when you finally promote him to the big leagues to help your team be productive and win games, that – he doesn't have to think about all this stuff. He's just going out there and competing. And really, the way that his pitches move, it's all going to play out. The numbers are all going to play out. And he's going to be the pitcher that he is with his stuff. And it's just not the place to do it in the big leagues.
You two are two of the more prominent saber-minded pitchers in baseball. Do you know or feel there are any saber-minded hitters in the league?
If you've ever read a Joey Votto interview, it jumps out pretty quick. And if you've ever faced Joey Votto and he's taking pitches this far off and you don't know why and it confuses you, it shows up pretty quick again by reading an interview. Beyond him, there are some I know that grasp some of the qualities. I'm starting to get there's some guys on the team this year that I'm starting to think they have something behind what they're working on right now, and it's based in that. But I don't know that I've heard of anybody really going on record as being in depth into it.
Yeah, I think you naturally see, and it's been a hot topic lately, the three true outcomes play out more, and whether it's organizations just preferring guys like that or hitters naturally realizing I'm more productive, my OPS goes up that way, or I get paid more if I'm that kind of guy. There's reasons why those types of players keep filtering up to the big leagues because they're more desirable. And so I think there is an application for hit effects and in practicing. So you're not just randomly wasting time in a cage. You're doing it with a purpose. And you can take kids with different body types, different bat speeds, different levels of ability, and kind of give them a range. Like, you know, you should be this type of hitter. You're going to be the most productive hitter if you have this kind of style. And you can't force a kid to hit a certain way. He's going to have a natural rhythm and timing. But you can show him. If you're small, you shouldn't be hitting fly balls. You're just giving away outs. You should really be putting the ball with more of a line drive swing, a lower launch angle. You're going to be more productive that way. So I think there are applications, but you don't see a ton of hitters. You really don't want to be thinking in the box like that.
No.
I mean, the ball is moving fast enough as it is. It's more of a preparation thing that you need to do well ahead of time as you're growing up and becoming a player, as opposed to doing it for the first time at the big league level.
It's hard to change. You don't see too many guys change. I mean, Sosa is a good example, that stuff aside, of someone whose walks jumped by a huge amount, but you don't see it alter very much. It's part of a skill set.
You see the small little changes.
Yep.
Josh Donaldson, when he came back up with Oakland a couple years ago, before he turned back into the monster that he is, when you looked at him in the minor leagues, he hit to all fields, he was successful. Came up to the big leagues, was one field oriented, and then all of a sudden he came back at the end of the year, and all of a sudden right field was in play for him. And it looks like he's just a better hitter, he's making more contact, but it's just a mindset shift that happened with him, that they did a good job with him finally getting him to grab hold of in the minor leagues, of that side of the field has to become alive. And at that point, once it might look like a small shift when it's on TV, you just see more success, but it was actually a massive, massive, massive thing that happened. and now all of a sudden he's on the verge of becoming a superstar because of it. So there are changes that happen,
yep.
But it's sometimes they just look like someone figured it out or a light went on when it's actually something else was behind it.
Yeah, guys knowing it, I think it's what you said intuitively. A lot of guys have an idea that getting on base is the thing. There aren't – Votto, I can tell you firsthand when people were – Dusty Baker was getting into it with him. Basically, if we were doing Sunday Night Baseball, he'd sit there and go in and talk to Dusty Baker, and Dusty would want him to swing a little bit more, and then I'd go and talk to Votto, and Votto would very clearly explain his perspective and understanding on not making outs and that type of thing. But I don't think there are too many guys in my experience, because I'm trying to find them all the time, but – that really get all of the concepts.
Yep.
And I think there's a natural transition that hitters go through. So if you're a big league pitcher and a young hitter comes up and you don't know what he's like and you go after him and all of a sudden he hits a rope off you, he hits a double off you, he hits a bomb off you, you're like, okay, I'm going to pitch this guy. You know, I'm going to be a little more careful here. And at some point, once he's established himself around the league that, hey, I'm a good hitter, I punish pitchers, all of a sudden, pitchers now start pitching more selectively to this guy. So he's made that transition past that new hitter, rookie hitter, and all of a sudden, now he's earned the right to be like a Joey Votto, to be like a Kevin Youkilis, where they go up there. I mean, I remember I used to face Youkilis in Fenway. I knew he wasn't going to swing first pitch, and I'd throw a ball, and I want to rip my glove in half on the first pitch because it was just a free strike. And so every time you miss it, you just drive yourself crazy because you know the guy's not going to swing, and Votto can be that way. So it's something, you know, Barry Bonds, all those guys that earned the right to go up there and not swing. It's something that a guy who you know isn't going to punish you at the plate, he never actually earns that right. Because, you know, as a pitcher, I'm going to throw a strike because you're really not going to damage me that much.
Time for one more. Go ahead.
So would you say that the players coming up are above average in terms of statistical literacy as more and more of them grew up in the Moneyball era?
I would probably depend on the definition of statistical literacy, I would think. You're familiar with OPS or certain things that are happening, but I would say probably not. They might be, again, without knowing they are, is probably the better way to put it. They might be familiar with the fact that walks are better than not walking or than making outs. So there might be some of the tenets that have grabbed hold with them. But I don't know that they actually know more than the previous generation. If you actually stopped and showed them these numbers on a piece of paper, it probably wouldn't make that much sense.
I honestly believe this transition is going to happen 1 to 2 generations from now. And the reason it's going to happen is because the coaches who are currently in the game, and I'm not down on them or anything, but when they came up in the game, it was a different game. It was play differently. My dad used to throw 150 pitches and then run 5 miles the next day. And that's what he did throughout his whole career. He had 3 knee surgeries because he did that. And it was just a different mentality. So when the current group of coaches who did things a certain way decades ago and the next generation comes in who they're okay with all these numbers and they're okay with how the front office does things now, I think you'll really start to see it push down to the player level more often. And it'll just be more integrated into the game.
All right. Thanks a lot, fellas.
Very good.